These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, of elections and beyond, thinking through the crisis in Western hegemony, Africa World Now Project is next. Knowledge is the intentional organization of information to meet an expressed objective and our objectives. Information unorganized is just that, bits of information. If this is indeed a viable conceptualization of knowledge, then the ability to correctly analyze the conditions within which a people find themselves must operate as praxis, consistently and constantly. Put another way, knowledge, a knowing as articulated through finding paths to meet objectives, can be measured through its information. Therefore, if intentionally and properly organized, then we should move closer to a or the objective. If we move further away or not at all, then we must interrogate the information that is being organized or not organized. At this point in the history of the world, Eurocentric mechanisms that organize human life are at a tipping point. As stated before, European modernity, rooted in the intellectual and material construction of a global order, as founded in the creation of whiteness, supported by the culture of racial capitalism, is rupturing. As a reaction, this whiteness, as an organizing construct, is attempting to hold its position of authority. Note I did not say power, because whiteness, which materialized as a practice of white supremacy, operates in a liminal space that is structured through violence majority of the world. This is not without protracted resistance and rebellion, of course. So its power is not absolute. While the United States is currently in the middle of what to some is a peculiar national election cycle, to others that critical thinking and radical vibrating other, this period is only peculiar in that we are once again in a cyclical discourse around voting in a settler nation that was organized on the attempted total genocide of native peoples, the forced physical and intellectual labor of African and African descendant, systemic and institutionalized race and racism, and continuous imperial engagement with the world. All of this, by the way, while we're in a global pandemic, despite those who seem to think otherwise. In order to maintain one's sanity living in such contradiction, one can only think with those who provide sharp and penetrating clarity when analyzing the discourses of the moment, from those who, through limited intellectual and practical capabilities, tell the least of these, the wretched of the earth, to vote because your life depends on it. Well, sir or madam, my life is dependent daily in a society that is organized to extract, dispossess, and marginalize from my very being. In thinking with radical intellectuals, such as George Jackson, who from the belly of the imperial machine itself argued that it isn't revolutionary or materialist to disconnect things, to disconnect revolutionary consciousness from revolutionizing activity, to build consciousness with political agitation and educational issue-making alone is idealistic rather than materialist. The effect has been reformism rather than revolution. When any election is held, it will fortify rather than destroy the credibility of the power brokers. When we participate in this election to win instead of disrupting, we are lending to its credibility and destroying our own. With all the factors of control over the electoral processes in the hands of the minority ruling class, the People's Party can always be made to seem isolated, unimportant, even irrelevant. From here, clarity becomes a realizable moment. Particularly when studying further, we read from George Jackson quoting Frantz Fanon, when people begin to express their disgust at the demagogic and reformist maneuvers of the vanguard parties, they will discover in real action a new form of political activity which in no way resembles the old. Thinking through the binary, the either-or category of thought that limits our capacities for strategic praxis in Western capitalist democracies, we see how the dialectical processes operate throughout the Africana world to create contradictions and opportunity. For example, Senegalese political economist Ndongo Samba Salai, echoing the scholarship of Samir Amin and the liberal virus, demystifies the celebratory language of free and transparent elections for liberal democracies in Africa as fictitious systems that benefit the economic elite in so much as they create an impression rather than a reality of the emancipated collective. According to Amin, this amounts to little more than low-intensity democracy, a fixed constitutional formula imposed from the West and designed to ensure continued dispossession and accumulation. If we apply the thought of Thomas Sankara as a lens, democracy then is not a gift that can be received from elsewhere. The very idea that a democratic model, valid everywhere and at all times, is unacceptable. Thomas Sankara is convinced that democracy is a historical construct, a set of tinkering here and there that makes sense for the community, and which more fundamentally allows people in their multiple determinations to express themselves freely and to emancipate themselves from different forms of subordination or dependencies. In South Africa, the EFF Founding Manifesto rightly points out that the political power that was transferred to the black majority through inclusive elections in 1994 was never transformed into economic freedom, as the majority of Africans remain on the margins of society as unemployed, underemployed, or discriminated against in their employment. While those who held economic, social, and political power since the colonial period continue to enjoy economic, social, and professional privileges. Said all this to say, we are at a juncture, an unavoidable fracture that is weaved into the social, political, and cultural fabric of the nation state. The conflicts inherent in political discourse, that is, the competing narratives between the political activity of the collective and the political act of the individual, is a manufactured reality in a capitalist democracy. Cedric Robinson provides more clarity for us on this. According to Robinson, capitalist democracy is one of the most powerful and enduring meta-narratives of modern Western historiography. As an ideological formation, it has inscribed discursive domains as distinctive as politics and science, policy and literature. As icon, its aura hovers over our institutions of knowledge and power, permeating inquiry and decision-making with the counterfeit certainties of predestination. Paradoxically, the iconic properties of capitalist democracy remain largely intact despite its hybrid character, grafting discourses of commerce and property to those of moral philosophy. In short, the lofty language that structures capitalist democracy to maintain its legitimacy through coerced consent does not match the realities and lived experiences of the historically and ethnically marginalized, quote, other, unquote. Robinson goes on, for generations, this condition of overdetermination has been due to the capacity of power to manufacture ideological negations of a more critical representation of the real. More recently, this achievement has prospered through technique, the seductions of information and scientific language. But consistently, one of the principal domains of capitalist democracy has been the production of history, the genealogy of the, quote, West, unquote, its ideological conduit. So what is to be done? How do we make sense of all of this? Today, of elections and beyond, thinking through the crisis in Western hegemony. I recently sat down with Coy Walker, professor of the humanities at Wake Forest University. Dr. Walker is the author of A Noble Fight, African-American Freemasonry and the Struggle for Democracy in America, co-editor of Community Wealth Building and the Reconstruction of American Democracy, Can We Make American Democracy Work?, the editor of the special issue of the Journal of Political Theology on Theology and Democratic Futures. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities of Standing Rock, Venezuela, Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program. I spit that Wonder Rhyme, me and my conglomerates
shall remain anonymous, caught up in the finest. Thank you for joining us. You know, taking the time to join us today, Dr. Walker. We are obviously in a very, very interesting moment of which seems to be a reverberation of multiple moments. We are having a part two conversation, part two of a conversation that we actually had literally maybe like a few days after the 2016 election. In 2016, obviously, we had a conversation then. And we covered a wide range of ideas, a wide range of things, but most importantly, really set the stage or set some of the parameters or set some of the ideas or things that were not being talked about that really can move us, you know, what really should have been paying, we should have been paying attention to move us to this particular moment. So I definitely invite our listeners to go ahead and, you know, go to our SoundCloud play, our SoundCloud page, our Spotify page to, you know, to pick up on that conversation. But again, here we are again. You know, I'm sitting here with one of my favorite thinkers, friends, comrades, you know, professionals, a big brother. I know you got brothers. I know, you know, you was a little brother, but now you're a big brother. So, you know, let's start this conversation. I mean, honestly, there's so much that we can jump into right now, but there are a few strands, a few thoughts here that I think we should set the parameters. One is this conversation around, you know, voting and electoral politics that, you know, is coming out of a number of segments of the population, because you have a part of the Black population, a part of the African descendant population, all into voting. And then there's on the opposite end of those who are saying, you know, protest votes are these type of votes. But the conversation, I think, is important, because what it does is really, to me, situates the conversation of Black political participation and Black political behavior in a longer genealogy. And for me, this point of party politics, this point of voting, this point of a protest vote, this point of, you know, finding some political stability, a political ground where policies can be developed. Really, I started to look particularly at what Fannie Lou Hamer was doing in Mississippi, particularly around this question of developing a party, developing, you know, a entity or institution, a voting bloc. So let's talk a little bit about where are we at this particular moment since 2016 on those questions of electoral politics, of those questions of Black rebellion. Where are we in this moment? Because we're at that moment again, and I'm not sure we're getting an understanding of the lessons of our ancestors, the lessons of those, our elders who are still here, who were fighting, you know, those particular battles. Where are we in the context of voting? Where are we in the context of this election? Where are we in the context of the world rebellion against authoritarianism and fascism and those particular? And again, that's a broad question, but I know you have the range and scope to be able to deal with that question.
Well, James, I want to thank you for having me on and inviting me back to revisit that conversation on the events of 11/8/2016. And just going back, thinking about that conversation, some of the issues that we raised did revolve around, the second big issue was the issue around voting and a broader political strategy for Black America and indeed for the African world. But we contextualize that within this sort of the emergence of a new wave of what Ronald Walters articulated as white nationalism. And that white nationalist wave in the post-World War II period, you know, from Goldwater consolidating under Reagan, and really revolutionized under Gingrich to the point where we get the populist, the authoritarian populism, to borrow from Stuart Hall, of a Donald Trump in 2016. This long wave of white nationalist politics that has eviscerated the liberal democratic state and has shrunk the arena for formal politics within the US, such that the range of political projects that can be scaled within our democracy has been limited severely. And what we've also seen is the evisceration of the social safety net and the continued exacerbation of the national security state, particularly in its post 9/11 guise. This has played and wreaked havoc on African-American politics in terms of what it has meant for Black voting behavior, both at the local and the national level, particularly since Shelby v. Holder in 2013 and the evisceration of preclearance from the Voting Rights Act. What we've seen is a fundamental restructuring of the American electorate along the lines of a white nationalist institutional tendency and a white nationalist ideological tendency. So what does this mean for us in our contemporary moment? We're in a moment of deep protests, both global and national, particularly the ongoing protests against police brutality, which I've written about this past summer for the American Philosophical Association. I see this in a long line. This is something that has not changed. What we're seeing is a heightened newness of it in this moment and for this particular generation, particularly in light of the assassinations of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. What we're seeing is the continuation of trying to respond to this deep nationalist dimension within American democracy that begins to challenge and constrain electoral possibilities. So what you have to, what we're seeing in Black and Brown communities throughout the US is trying to figure out how we should begin to engage in formal politics nationally, as well as how do you begin to engage in formal electoral politics locally. So we see a number of local races, a number of local electoral representatives, Cori Bush being one, that are coming to the national scene. But we're also seeing folks who are saying, well, are we seeing the end or the exhaustion of electoral politics? And I would hedge against that. I mean, I said, what we learned from the long Black freedom movement is that it is about multiple strategies along multiple terrains. So there has to be an electoral strategy commensurate with a broad-based grassroots strategy that seeks to change the terrain of democracy itself. You also have to have a strategy to march through the institutions. What we're seeing, you know, with the rise in, with in the assault on the Voting Rights Act is a long-term struggle of the right. Stephen Tellis does a wonderful analysis of this, of the conservative legal movement in his book, The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement. These things don't just come in a vacuum. They're long-term planned and long-term in terms of planning, ideological formation, as well as their execution. So we have to be just as deliberate and just as strategic and just as tactical. So in 2020, what we're seeing is a tactical movement, a tactical electoral strategy, because we understand that another 4 years under a Trump regime would eviscerate some of the deep foundational dimensions of even attempting a deepening of democratic politics, particularly with Trump unleashing a populist authoritarianism, a white supremacy, and also this is global, his planetary sensibility of his reactionary America First foreign policy. We are in a crisis moment. It's a crisis moment nationally in terms of our politics and democratic deficit. We are in a crisis in a planetary sense, since we are facing a existential threat to all of human life with climate change, and also with our continuing and ongoing threat of nuclear war. And we're facing a deep instability and a deep instability in human institutions by the rise of authoritarian movements in these global centers, Modi in India, Bolsonaro in Brazil, and of course, Trump in the US. So with all of what we're facing, there are what electoral strategy enables us to do is to begin to try to choose the terrain on which we're going to continue to engage in the long struggle to realize some semblance of democracy in the U.S., as well as continuing the long Black freedom struggle.
So thank you for, kind of diving into that question. But there are four particular things we need to unpack here, right? Mm-hmm. And let's go back up to the notion of multiple strategy being linked to the grassroots. Because when we're talking about the context of voting, we're talking about the context of strategy and the context of being able to respond to this white nationalism, the question that is at the center of this move towards white nationalism is a consolidation of this notion of whiteness that includes human, right? So there is a question, it's really a fundamental question of one's humanity, right? So white nationalists, it's state using the state apparatus and its different functions of the state is to really to continue the dehumanization of African people or people of African descent or anything that it considers to be other. So there, to me, there's really this exacerbation, I'm saying this is a proliferation, a hyperitization of an otherness that is going on, a re-otherness, and to consolidate who was considered to be the other and who was considered to be outside of any human activity, let alone any electoral activity. So what I'm saying here is that if we're talking about multiple strategies and we're talking about, being linked to, grassroots movement, there's a conflict there, because what I say is that many on the grassroots are looking at what's happening for those who are using strategies such as electoral politics. But a lot of times, Black folk who are engaged in that also get wrapped up into the system itself that does not meet the needs or does not or separates itself from the grassroots itself. So I'm here thinking what Fanon and Cabral talks about, this notion of the lack of ideology or the lack of some type of guiding principle for that strategy. And so that's where I'm seeing that's where the conflict is. The conflict is really a fundamental question of one's humanity, which the grassroots feel those processes of dehumanization and that they're looking and moving and bubbling up and resisting against those particular structures, trying to find a way, trying to find a broad-based, an internationalism. There's conversation. And as you know, we look at it in the international. One of the things that in this long struggle of Africana freedom movement is that there was always international as well. So what I'm saying is that let's unpack that. When we're looking at electoral possibilities in the context of grassroots strategies, there's some class differences that happen there. Let's talk about that. When we're talking about strategies, we're talking about addressing these issues. Those strategies sometimes, as you see, like ideologically, they're going to clash.
Well, I don't think that all grassroots move in a particular way. We have to begin to understand that, the authoritarian populism of a white nationalism under Trump, that is also a grassroots movement. And it has been part and parcel of the American political scene since the 70s. And in the 80s, it really came on the agenda for our formal security apparatus. In the early 80s, there are a series of FBI reports that are warning about the mobilization of white supremacy. So when we look at Timothy McVeigh in 1995 and what we see in Charlottesville in 2017, they become the eruptions of these long-term trends. So what you're seeing is communities being mobilized around a community being mobilized around a particular identity, a particular ideology. And when we begin to try to link a particular politics at the grassroots level, a politics of civil society, if you will, along with the politics in formal political arena, policy, voting, and so forth, a politics around a legal strategy, and then a politics around the ideological dimension, then we have to begin to understand that there's going to be all of these levels, these four levels we just delineated, won't all articulate in the same manner, with the same intensity, in the same direction, and that there must be a constant and continued struggle for those minds and actions of individuals to move in a certain way that we wish them to move. So it's not just by, this isn't, politics isn't theology. Someone has some revelation and then all of a sudden everyone moves in a particular direction. And that's what I think we have to begin to understand, that folks, particularly those of us who are on the left, what we have to do is we have to continue the struggle to not only articulate our particular positions, not only to support and sustain those civil society organizations, which are proliferating across the nation, not only create new experiments in the formal political arena, things like what we're seeing in Jackson, Mississippi, around cooperatives, and also in Cleveland, Ohio, and Rochester, New York, with new forms of ownership, with community control of the economy, and also with new forms of inviting democratic action in policy arena. The deep legal strategy, what we see with the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights when in Virginia, when we saw that that the voting that voting registration, the main server lines were cut, it was the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights who were able to then file the complaint and file an injunction to then extend voter registration for an additional 2 days. The ideological is not the only dimension. I mean, and this is where the struggle is, because folks are, it's either all or none. Either we're in a moment where we're either or, with or against. I mean, we're in this Schmittian moment. And of course, Amy Cesaire in Discourse on Colonialism reminds us that we don't live either or lives, and we don't need to respond to either or questions. This is a complex and multi-dimensional issue and crisis we're facing. And when we begin to engage and articulate this at the level of the planetary, then we realize that we can't just save Black lives in the US without connecting them to Black and brown and red and all lives across the planet. Because the crisis that we're facing is a planetary crisis, a crisis of climate change, a crisis of nuclear annihilation. So we see new formations emerging. The Progressive International just held its first convening in September. This continues to try to provide some space for the expression of a new type of politics at an ideological level, but also to begin to connect that with all of the proliferating grassroots movements at local levels, and to give them particular scale. That's what we're facing today. And this is what this 2020 election means. Can we move these grassroots progressive movements in the US to scale in the formal political arena of American democracy, locally, statewide, and nationally? Because what we've seen with the Republicans and what we've seen with conservative forces is they have been, you know, proper Leninists and marched through institutions. I mean, you remember back in the 80s, they wanted to make sure and they argued for and fought for the right for school boards to be elected. And of course, once they got elected school boards, you had the evisceration of public education, ideologically, testing regimes come into power, the consolidation of textbook industry by conservative states, particularly Texas. And of course, the evolution and deepening of school choice, which really cut funding for public schools and then funneled it to private schools.
21 pounds, 21 pounds, 21 pounds, 21 pounds. Yeah.
So when Columbus got here,
You are currently listening to a recent conversation I had with Corey Walker, where we attempt to interject a broader analysis and disrupt the rampant normative conversations around our current moment. That is, conversations that are rooted in how things should be, rather than a clear analysis of the conditions as they are, organizing that information intentionally to map a future. We are exploring the elections and beyond, thinking through the crisis in Western hegemony. Dr. Walker is the author of A Noble Fight, African-American Freemasonry and the Struggle for Democracy in America, co-editor of Community Wealth Building and the Reconstruction of American Democracy, Can We Make American Democracy Work?, and editor of the special issue of the Journal of Political Theology on Theology and Democratic Futures. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities of Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Continue to enjoy the program.
And he didn't know what it meant to be a human being.
Really cut funding for public schools and then funneled it to private schools and these conservative. And then now what they're using is the idea of religious freedom to then freight it to Christian conservative schools. And now that's the new context. But it started very small. Let's fight for elected school boards. And this is what you're seeing in grassroots strategies. I mean, here in Richmond, we have a wonderful progressive who's running for mayor of the city of Richmond, Alexis Rogers, and she comes out both in formal politics with the Democratic Party and the state, but also grassroots electoral politics, grassroots politics, and really catalyzing that terrain. If we don't win in 2020, can't give up. Struggle keeps going, organization keeps going. You got to continue to build it. You got to continue to create folks, enable people to join the movement, find themselves within it, understand that it is grassroots, it is formal, it is legal, and it is ideological. And of course, all of this really hinges on how we come, how we begin to think through the processes of a new day and the politics of a new day in a post-pandemic moment. How do we begin to envision a new world and then begin to actualize it? And then, of course, how we begin to rebuild the structures of some sort of international political regime, possibly coming out of the Progressive International, that can then deal with the global climate issues that we're facing. Because what COVID-19 has made extremely clear in these waves of pandemics that we've had since 1918 is that the human race, humanity itself, cannot act solely within the artificial confines of the nation state when we face a planetary crisis.
So let's unpack this, because you went exactly, actually you jumped ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
I think that's because, you know, the processes is that, you know, the sociology of knowledge, right? The idea that we're looking, and there are folk who are looking at this and looking at this beyond, you know, really understanding the terrain of struggle. And the reason why I invoked Cabral and Fanon, but in particular Cabral, is that he was very clear about understanding the conditions within which you're fighting. That does not look the same way in every particular community or in every particular locality. However, I'm going to think about what Malcolm X talks about a number of times, is a lot of times we mix up the means with the objective. We try to look for a means to be that panacea, that magic bullet, which is very, very dangerous, because when you're talking about the grassroots, which your point about, you know, we've talked about this, we've read stuff, we wrote about it, we've talked about the idea that this consolidation of white nationalism, that was a global project. It was a grassroots movement working particularly in communities here in the United States in Latin America, the Caribbean, Central America, but they all were having international conversations to consolidate.
When parts of those when parts of the white nationalist movement in North Carolina were going over and fighting in Ukraine, and then coming back to the U.S., learning tactics, strategies, ideologies, and bringing it back, the ways in which they mobilize and utilize social media and draw from this global imaginary in these local communities. This is what we are concerned about. This is what is on that radar. This is what you're exactly right. What Cabral is saying at that tricontinental meeting in 67 and the weapon of theory, what he's arguing is, look, if we're talking about revolution, just because the revolution in Cuba operated in the mountains and in the Sierra Maestra doesn't then give me the idea that the only way we can have revolution is if we have mountains, and then if we group and move out of the mountains into the plains. Where he's fighting in Guinea-Bissau, there were no mountains. So the question becomes, oh, so I don't have a revolution? Cabral is like, no, you have to look at those conditions. This is the deep lesson of Marx. And did you look at that period, 1848 to 1852? 1848, you get the revolution of 1848. Marx unleashes the Communist Manifesto, which is purely, you know, this progressive history, this idea, you know, we're going to overcome with communism. But what happens by 1852? You have the counter-revolution, and then he comes with the 18th Brumaire. And that's where you get Napoleon's nephew crowning himself in a coup as the emperor of the Second Empire. And this is, Marx makes that famous statement, first time tragedy, second time farce. But in that second paragraph, what Marx does is reminds us that people don't create history on the terrain that they select. You create history on the terrain of the given. And this is what Cabral reanimates in 67. And this is what we're seeing right now. We're having to operate on a terrain that is fundamentally structured by the past, by certain political actions. And what we've done since 2016 is begin to track that emergence of this new expression of white nationalism in this moment. But we've also connected it to a deep ideology grounded in a certain conservative politics wrapped in a patina of Christian nationalism that then gives the nation its mythos, but also within a certain form of corporate and capitalist capture of the commons. So we understand that the terrain has fundamentally shifted. It's deepened. Resistance is always there. I mean, and this is where we give, we understand the expressions and the transformations of grassroots. Who would have imagined a decade ago that Black Lives Matter would serve as a rallying cry and a convening call for a type of mass politics, protest politics, that would then move planetary and that would also be sustained for a long period of time. We would not have imagined that, but that's what's happening in this moment. And I think folks who sort of give an analysis or a short shift to that refuse to engage in a materialist understanding of what's going on in the world. And you see folks running for office. I mean, we're getting folks who are not only running locally, in Mississippi, we get, you know, progressive folks running in New York. We are also seeing the ways in which people are beginning to shift the conversation. And I think that those shifts, however timid and tentative they are in our particular moment, those shifts would not have occurred outside of a shift in popular thinking and mobilization that has long been coming. I mean, you think of the Gen of Six, Trayvon Martin, up until our particular moment right now.
And that's important because I would say, you know, to your point, there are groups who really believe in the radical and Black imagination. And the reason why I would say in the dominant discourse, I would agree that, the imagination or to imagine that Black Lives Matter would be, you know, on the lips and as a platform. A lot of us did because, again, we have an internationalist perspective. And I think what we're really talking about here, if to piggyback on your point about, you know, the idea of envisioning a society and envisioning a world beyond these particular, but also understanding the conditions to fight for that world, right, becomes important because we talked about, you know, the objectives and the means. But I want to eventually get to this planetary crisis because I think this is going to really provide a deeper perspective and an added perspective, because a lot of times, I mean, that's really a question of humanity and who has the right to live in the context of growing or less and less resources being available, I should say, because that's what we're really talking about. When we're talking about the idea of Africana movements or Black movements or Africana movements, one of the problems that I see is that the divorce from international perspectives, international struggle that were set, or the parameters were set for us to understand by folks such as Claudia Jones, C.L.R. James, those are just a few names, Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer provides a very, you know, and I want to go back to Fannie Lou Hamer and her, you know, are we reading Fannie Lou Hamer properly in the context of developing, you know, a party, party politics? Because, of course, a lot of folk on the left and on the radical side of the left are basically calling for, you know, the consolidation or for another political party, a third option, so to speak, or a not necessarily a third option, but because there's multiple parties. I want to be clear about what I'm saying. I'm understanding that we know there's multiple parties here. But I want to look at Ella Baker and what she, are we reading Ella Baker and what they were doing properly? Are we reading that through class interest? Are we looking at Ella Baker through a class interest to say, I'm sorry, Fannie Lou Hamer. Ella Baker was in that particular will, but Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, as being the spearhead of this, the Mississippi Democratic Party. I always get a mixed up.
MFDP, yeah.
So are we reading that properly? Are we reading that through a particular class lens that we're actually missing or misinterpreting what was happening in that particular moment? Because I see that moment is that she was disrupting, you know, these notions of, she was questioning this notion of democracy. She's questioning these notions of citizenship. At the same time, she's trying to consolidate the power of grassroots Black folk at the, you know, across boundaries, across ideological boundaries, across, you know, because she understood the terrain of struggle from a, obviously, the most grassroots level, but was very articulate in being able to see a society beyond. Are we reading, you know, what they were doing properly, or class interest co-opting that?
Well, I think that what you're asking is very important, simply because the class interest, the ways in which we understand ideological production and reproduction, particularly in our moment, and how certain voices are elevated in the public discourse that then serve as the agenda setting, discourse, begin to challenge and frustrate and constrain the ways in which we begin to develop resources for our particular politics now. I'm reminded that roughly about a year ago, I think it was a year ago, I taught a class at when I was at the University of Richmond on organic leadership, lessons from the Black Freedom Movement. And we took up Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker as exemplars of an organic leadership that was not tethered to the dominant models of hierarchical forms of leadership. Instead, they were cultivating, they were creating the context and cultivating the character, values, and virtues of everyday folk to assume leadership in their communities. And Ella Baker's statement, "A strong people don't need strong leaders," is really what catalyzed her vision around how we must begin to engage in the dominant, not only electoral politics, but also community organizing for people power. So when we look at and begin to engage the MFDP, it's around that vision of leadership. It's around a vision where Fannie Lou Hamer comes to a church meeting at the insistence of Moses, who came, Bob Moses, who came down the river and found herself able to begin to realize her leadership abilities and capabilities all while they were always already there. And that is the model of a radical type of deep democratic politics that then can move into the formal political arena. I mean, the MFDP is going to desegregate the Mississippi Democratic Party. And they're going to place a formal challenge to the National Democratic Party. And of course, they're working with folks back in D.C. at SNCC headquarters, people like Thelwell and others who are then beginning to mobilize in and around this. Now, they this is where Bob Moses, after that defeat, Fannie Lou continues. And eventually she says, we're going to create our own party. And this is what she does in the 70s. And she's also going to articulate some particular political messages around women's reproductive rights that were not as progressive as her democratic vision. But at the same time, Moses, at that point, Bob becomes disenchanted with formal politics because of what happened. Goes international. And then of course he's back in the US and still operating at the grassroots. And of course what we see with Ella Baker is speaking out and connecting movements and struggles. Fannie Lou does that with her work and conversations with X and then travels to the continent. And she's beginning to see that the conditions in Mississippi are the same conditions that folks are facing on the continent. So what we have to do then is, with this particular understanding, those resources then enable us in our particular moment to not only critically assess the political terrain that we're on, but also to begin to shape and cultivate those political cultures, those communal cultures that nurture and embody those types of values around a leadership model that isn't hierarchical, around models that cultivate and nurture the deep characteristics and virtues of everyday people, and ones that begin to articulate new models in our moment. So how do we do this in our particular moment? We're seeing that with the emergence of these of national leaders who are deeply connected to local communities. And what we have now is, and you've always had multiple mediums of communication, but the speed and also the visual dimension of those communications give rise to a certain ability for these personalities to come to emerge nationally. How do we empower those voices? How do we sustain those movements? How do we then enable them to proliferate in multiple spaces? How do we then facilitate the denial of corporate capture of these movements? I mean, this is the thing that we see, you know, when Black Lives Matter becomes a television commercial, we then have to figure out, okay, this provides a certain elevation, a certain representation, but also what are the deleterious effects of this? And then how do we continue to maintain the momentum beyond representational politics to deep structural and organizational change? that's where the example of Ella and Fannie Lou remind us that this is not just a one-time struggle. It's not a singular event. It operates locally and globally. It operates through an ethos and also a principled position that recognizes the worth, value, and dignity of all of humanity. And it realizes and it recognizes that freedom operates on multiple levels. We're gonna organize communities. Of course, Fannie Lou Hamer then organizes these cooperative farms because this is folks need to eat. So if we have that crisis and food security, which we still have and it's deepening today, just the report came out that as a result of the loss of government support, COVID-19 support, another 8 million individuals have gone into poverty. We have food banks that are working at maximum capacity. We have the insistence on the evisceration of social safety nets. And we have a looming state and local budgetary crisis that's coming up in 2021. So we see these things on the horizon. How do we organize for that? How do we organize electorally in this moment? We're 19, 18 days out from the national election. What Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker remind us of is that these are multiple struggles. We need multiple strategies grounded in a deep and principled vision of not only human dignity and the worth and the worth of human variety, but also it is grounded in a deep principle of deep democracy, that we have to develop a vision of democracy and a realization of democracy that recognizes the inherent ability and the inherent worth of every citizen and every person to the democratic project. And that does rub up against, you know, hierarchical visions of democracy or hierarchical visions of top-down leader models. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't permit folks to give up the struggle for a just and righteous world.
And to kind of unpack this conversation, a discourse even around democracy, because this becomes contentious, particularly for those on the radical left, for those who look at the practical, the theoretical, the philosophical foundations of the discourse of democracy as currently understood, the dominant discourse, to be clear, it does not necessarily meet the perspectives of the Africana or the needs of the Africana Black freedom movement itself being a collective process, a collective enterprise. And what I'm here, if we really look at the origins of democracy, democracy was not, you know, really developed. The discourse of democracy that is rooted in a Western epistemology was really rooted in a class base. It was really segregated. It did not mean to include, everyone into that particular notion. However, if we are to decenter that and look at the ideas and practices of Africa and African communities and other indigenous communities, they provide a different narrative or a different discourse that really fits the aims and the objectives of a Black freedom movement or an Africana freedom movement that includes an expansion of an idea of what it means to be an individual, to make them part of a collective, meaning, you know, you get into these ancient principles or these ideas are I am because you are because I am. And then the other variations of that across the continent of Africa that also filter into the diaspora, but also have communication with indigenous communities and their ancient practices and philosophical understandings of the world that includes taking care of nature, being in a steward, being a custodian, being a partner with the universe, So now, I mean, I think that, you know, that conversation is a needed conversation, because, you know, to say democracy in a number of circles, most people kind of run with it, erroneously centered discourse in Western historiography and historicity, right? So this idea needs to be decentered. It needs to be expanded, which goes back to one of the things, and then I can let you respond, I'm sorry. one of the things that I think that also narrows folk conversation, particularly here in the United States, around electoral politics and around this hierarchy and these types of things, is that we, you know, the divorce of the radical imagination from the international struggle for of African people. So once you start to expand one's notion of what the terrain of struggle is, the less hierarchical the idea is. Because once you expand something, you know, you're now flattening it out. You're now, you know, ranging. You're providing a scope for that. And I know I said a few things there, but let's start with that decentering the conversation of democracy.
I think, we political theorists and political philosophers, recognize that democracy is not a fiat accompli. There's a deep anti-democratic tradition within the discourse of democracy. I mean, Plato's Republic is a classic anti-democratic text. And of course, we have some deeply anti-democratic tendencies within the American experiment with democracy. We're concerned with majoritarian politics. Democracy always has to be attenuated from its majoritarian tendencies. So you get the Senate, of course, you get the Electoral College, and of course, you get the judiciary. So that doesn't then discount all instantiations of how we understand the concept of democracy, simply because it is a discourse that's deeply contested and conflicted. I'm reminded that you want to read some of the deep conversations around slavery during the Constitutional Convention and the adoption of the Constitution. The anti-slavery rhetoric and the anti-slavery vision is articulated in and through the Federalist Papers. Some of the Federalist Papers, you can find, the critique why the Constitution makes these concessions in and around slavery. So we recognize that. We also recognize that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, after the American Civil War and the War for Black Liberation, becomes the polity is rewritten fundamentally and foundationally. And what folks are doing is creating what Stuart Hall said, a sense of contestation around democracy. It is the definition and meaning and its instantiation.
To the team. Myself to see if I could feel. Then I began to pray to see if God was real. I said, I'll see and reveal.
That was a conversation where we were thinking through the crisis in Western hegemony, exploring the elections and beyond with Corey Walker, professor of the humanities at Wake Forest University. Due to time constraint, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Now Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Nail Project. Leroy Jones to Haj Malik El Shabazz from Detroit Red and to the polar opposite of what your report said. That's it for Africa World Nail Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnailproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher, and content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent. Got the bop gun loaded up to kill one. Drop cruising like...